Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
This edition of the Hagman Report. This is for Friday, June 30th, 2023. With me, as I said yesterday, and still here, believe it or not, still here, Jack Cashel, the absolute incredible writer, the author of some 15 books, something like that. I don't know, double digits, more, maybe 16, but a bunch, including... Oh, you remember Ron Brown's Body, and then, of course, TWA 800. This is coming out in paperback later this month to commemorate the events of that fateful day. Boy, wow, what a read that is. They're all good reads, as well as, that's right, Unmasking Obama. Have you read this one? If you haven't, why not? And many more. If you go to... you can go to Amazon and check all of his books out. But his latest book, Untenable, The True Story of White Ethnic Flight from America's Cities. It's right there. And look at that. You can see it right there. And you know what? It's coming out next week, the 4th of July. So here's what you can do. You can order it now, either right now or as soon as the show is over. But definitely order it, because, you know, you watch, like I do, the social media stuff. You see the things taking place in the inner cities, and all of a sudden you say something about what's going on. I'll just be straight up. I mean, you see a group of black Utes. That's right. That word was used in the book, black Utes. my cousin Vinny. Remember that? You see them, beating a white woman or a white man up. And you see a lot of commentary about that. And, there's, of course, if you comment on that, you're a racist. You can't be a racist. That's one thing Jack Cashel gets into. Very, very, very well done, too. And then, of course, there are many other things along that line. Pretty much what you see, again, within social media, what's going on, why it's taking place. All of that is in the book Untenable. It's about white flight from American cities and why it's taking place. This would be a good, I'll tell you what, this would be a good book to get your professor, your teacher, your... crazy uncle that lives in your attic, or hey, your coworker, or anyone, or just yourself, to learn about what's really taking place and why it's taking place. We left off the last episode. We left off talking, and it's hard for me to even put these two words together. Reparations debate. We left off talking about that. So let's get back into it. Jack, well, by the way, before I get with me as well is private investigator Susan Daniels. Now, she has a book, and maybe we'll get her on for 10 minutes, 5, 10, 15 minutes, whatever, to talk about it. The Rubbish Hauler's Wife versus Barack Obama. If you haven't read that book, that's out, either Kindle or paperback. Definitely read that book, The Rubbish Hauler's Wife versus Barack Obama. And believe it or not, when I read that book, I did not know this, but we actually have some common history among certain things going, certain things in her early life. It's a great read, The Rubbish Hauler's Wife versus Barack Obama. And during the earlier we were talking, so I don't have to go on. I said, well, you started all this with the Social Security number and all this stuff. And that's really what this book is about, exposing Barack Hussein Obama and having the guts to do so. And that's Susan Daniels' PI. Definitely grab a hold of that book too. But again, with me is Jack Cashel talking about reparations debate. That's where we left off. Before I go any further into the weeds, let's talk more. Let's pick up where we left off.
Yeah, yesterday. Doug, and thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure. And,
oh,
and thanks for Susan for coming in here. I'm a big fanboy of Susan Daniels. So
this is
an incredible story. I was invited to participate in a reparations debate.
Right.
It was staged by a good group called American Public Square and to be televised on the American, the PBS station in Kansas City where I live,
yep.
KCPT. They had a very hard time finding a second person to be on my side.
Which blew my mind.
That's scary.
Yeah.
They had three people on the other side who were, you know, could say whatever they wanted to because no one was going to check them. So I was saying how I started off the debate. I started talking about, I wanted to throw them off balance right from the beginning. And so instead of saying the obvious stuff that when people say reparations, are you crazy? I never owned a slave. You were never a slave. What are we talking about here? I wanted to talk about the real problem at hand, and it's the heart of my book, Untenable.
Yep.
And so I imagine the world through, I started by saying, I find myself listening to 1950s music on my among my presets on Sirius. And I asked myself why, and I said, because it's so upbeat, right?
Yep.
It's so hopeful and forward-looking. And then I looked it up. Of the 50 top hits of the 50s, 24 were by black artists. One of those artists was Fats Domino. And I picked Fats Domino for a reason, and I said, let's say it's 1958, it's his 30th birthday, he's looking around the world, he sees all this kind of black progress, all the barriers coming down, but he still sees an intact black family with strong black communities, strong black churches. He's Catholic, by the way.
Right.
And he's seen a lot. He's from New Orleans. It's not like he's naive, but he knows that this is forward progress coming. And he goes, and I said that he has sees that the black community has well survived, better than you might have thought, institutional white racism, the era of institutional white racism. I said, but what he cannot anticipate is what's right around the corner, and that's the era of institutional white guilt. And I said, that will be the real killer. That's seductive and destructive, and will have a hugely negative impact on the black family, and we're not even prepared to talk about it.
Well, okay, but is, and I'm being honest here, is institutional white racism a thing?
It was.
It was.
Yeah.
But is it now?
No.
Thank you.
No, it's a fraud. It's a con. It's a grift. It's a way to perpetuate
exactly
a grievance and the very existence of the word microaggression, right, which speaks to the absurd. If your aggressions against you are micro, right?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, as I told my audience at this the reparations debate, and it's a liberal audience, about 20% black, hostile to me.
Yeah.
I said, you're all one percenters, right? Every one of you in this room is a one percenter by world standards.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And so we're dividing up the spoils, but. And then I went on, you know, but here was the interesting thing. When they showed the televised version, right, of this debate,
yeah.
It wasn't done live, it was edited. There were 40 minutes of time in which one of the five panelists was speaking, right? At the edited version, the pro side got 29 minutes, we got 11. And they edited out my whole opening statement.
Really?
In which I set up my premise.
Boy, color me surprised. Okay.
Public TV? Can you imagine that?
Oh, no, I can't. Oh, no.
So I said, well, that's the way they roll. But the discouraging thing was listening. I mean, so the one lady was there. She was from Evanston, Illinois, which has a reparations program in place. And she's talking about reparations, and they're saying, well, they could do it in Evanston. They could do it in Kansas City. Why not? I said, Evanston isn't Kansas City. I said, Evanston is Lawrence, Kansas. It's a university town. Trump got 7% of the vote in Evanston, right? I mean, it's a guilty, affluent university town. And One thing that did not make the TV edit was when she's talking about redlining. Now, they're moving beyond slavery and Jim Crow, and right. they want current phenomena for which they could reasonably claim reparations. And in this woman's case, she made the case about reparations. What she did not mention was that 82% of the people who lived within redlined areas were white. They're excluded. They're not part of the program.
Really?
And let me explain just redlining.
Yeah,
there's a lot of in the book, I get to expose a whole lot of myths. Redlining, myth. Public housing architecture as the problem, a myth. Divided highways, racist highways.
What's redlining, though? I mean, to people who don't know.
Yeah. What happened, and everything bad that's happened to black people in America is a product of the Democratic Party, actually.
Okay.
And
right.
the redlining comes out of the Roosevelt administration, FDR administration, Federal Housing Authority. They offered support to loans, to prop up loans. But the bankers were in individual cities. They outlined areas where the loans were too risky.
Correct.
To justify governmental support.
Yep.
They were red line.
Okay.
Now, what the people who were red line didn't understand and still don't understand today is that the banks were doing them a favor. Because I talk to so many people, and you know these people, no matter what city you live in, who bought a home, kept that home up, invested in the home, and at the end of the day couldn't sell that home because no one would buy it.
That's right.
Because the neighborhood collapsed around them.
Yep.
And starting in the early 90s with the Community Reinvestment Act, when they put teeth into it, that the absence of the supporting of home loans to people who couldn't afford them otherwise or sustain them ended up with the subprime crisis 2008. So there's a lot of things they don't know or don't want to know.
Right.
So to bring those up in debate was like, as my ally on the thing, he goes, Jack, this is going to be like shooting fish in a barrel. I said, it is, but we can't kill the fish. We can just stun them, you know, because, you know, they have the moral high ground. We're just going to stun the fish, let them wander around in their stupid little tank for a while. But I don't know that, you know, my goal in the reparations debate was just to, I didn't expect to convert anyone. I just wanted to weaken their confidence in their arguments. I wanted to have my little thoughts dangling in their head when they start talking about redlining or all these other things.
Right.
But in the book, in Untenable, I go through this. So many of the things that we've been told, two things that the left have done to justify the destruction of the black community, which they're responsible for.
Okay.
They found scapegoats, and that's us, right?
Yep.
And then they started making up excuses, mythologies, like racist highways, which we talked about yesterday.
Right.
Nonsense. Redlining, nonsense.
Right.
You know, also nonsense is the notion that there was, when you read the anti-racist crowd, that is like the, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ibram Kendi and these people. And then there's white ones who are cashing in on this. Robin DiAngelo, right? White fragility, please. I'd love to talk to you. I'd love to debate these people. Timothy Wise.
Oh.
They imagine a conspiracy. And in their eyes, what happened with white flight is that real estate operators motivated by the government would chase white people out of neighborhoods while their friends would be out in the suburbs with homes to sell to them. These are conspiracy theories. This isn't sociology. It didn't work that way.
Right.
And then, as I was saying yesterday, Doug, in my neighborhood, it's 90% renters. You can't block bust when people don't own their own homes. That's one of the great myths. And in the book, I talk about the story of the hiring black women to push baby carriages down white neighborhoods, right? We've heard that story. I mean, it's part of urban folklore now.
Yeah.
I said, I wonder if I could find the source of that.
And?
Could not.
why not?
There are a lot of things I could not find the source of. Uh-huh. You know, and that was just one of them. So they fill us with these urban legends that people take it for as gospel. Yep. They find scapegoats, and things keep getting worse and worse and worse. Because as in the reparations debate, no one wanted to face the reality of what life is like in the black America today. For instance, I said at one point, as a demonstration, This is in Kansas City. Those of you who know Kansas City, it's right on a state line.
Right.
Now, I live a mile from the state line. On the other side of the state, I live in a very nice, virtually all white neighborhood right in the middle of Kansas City.
Okay.
Black people don't live there because they don't want to send their kids to public schools. So our neighbor is de facto gay and Catholic, right? Just an odd mix, but that's the way
okay.
it is.
Okay.
Because we don't depend on public schools.
Okay.
Immediately across state line is a pleasant suburban county. It's Johnson County, right?
Okay, yep.
As I pointed out in 2021, I had the numbers. I said in our city of Kansas City with 500,000 people, we had 159 murders. In Johnson County, with 600,000 people, they had 4 murders. We're right, you know, and we have the same gun laws. Missouri and Kansas both being, you know, open carry states.
Okay.
I said, right. Why is it that in Kansas City, Missouri, you're 47 times more likely to be murdered than you are a mile away? And the moderator said, what does that have to do with anything? I said, what I'm pointing out here is that we have a dysfunctional community.
Yeah.
And until we begin to ask, why is it dysfunctional? The notion of reparations is just, we're just rearranging deck chairs here. We're not getting to the heart. That iceberg is, you know, poking through the bottom of the ship. They didn't want to tackle. They just ignored it. They just simply ignored my arguments. And I kept reinforcing that throughout the evening. So there's not a serious conversation going on. But as I suggested when talking about the failure of anyone to want to show up to do it, you think some civic leader is going to stand up and say no when the reparations commission comes back and say we want X, Y, and Z? It's not going to happen.
No.
So if your city has a reparations commission, start looking to your wallets because they're coming after them.
I'll tell you, it's just hard for me to believe. Again, those two words don't belong together in my view. But going back to what you said about the number of murders, I mean, so what did you attribute or could you attribute that to?
There's one cause, and that's family breakdown.
There it is.
And it's odd because when I said that in the debate, someone applauded, and then everyone hissed the third person applauding.
It was the dad back there. Yeah.
And I, you know, because it's when you look at it now in Kansas City, just and here's what aggravates it. And just like it aggravated in the 60s, when the murder rate in a city like Newark went up by a factor of 7.
Yeah.
Not 7%, 7 times.
Right.
Over a period from 1950 to 72, from 24 murders to 68 murders or something.
Okay.
The aggravation factor is the fanning of the flames by groups like BLM, for instance.
Right.
I wrote a book on the George Zimmerman case called If I Had a Son.
Yes.
And I've gotten to know George very well, by the way, and it's a heartrending story. But and just to give you, this is a funny kind of anecdote, but I was having lunch with him and his parents a few years ago. He still lives in Florida because he was taking care of his grandmother and then his father who since died. But
and if you don't mind, George Zimmerman is?
The man who shot and killed Trayvon Martin.
Right.
And why this is relevant is because when George Zimmerman was acquitted in the murder of Trayvon Martin, Black Lives Matter formed the next day.
Okay.
That's because they ignored all the facts in the trial.
Right.
So, but here's the politics of it are not coincidental. So I'm having lunch with George, and he's Hispanic. His first language is Spanish. His mother's from Peru.
All right.
And she wanted to name him after his uncle Jorge. And I said to George, I said, you know, if your name had been Jorge Zimmerman, we never would have heard of you. And he said, you're absolutely right. And I said, because the media would have wanted to have nothing to do in a battleground state in 2012 with a fight between a Jorge and a Trayvon, right?
Man, it all comes down to politics.
Yeah.
I mean,
and then the mom says, this is classic mom, turns to her husband and says, I told you we should have called him Jorge. So
wow.
Black Lives Matter is formed. And just to show you the impact of this radicalization of the black young, because this happened in the 60s also.
Okay.
It's rehappening now. We had a period of relative peace. So in 2014, for instance, in the first 9 months of that year, Kansas City had 41 murders.
Okay.
In 9 months. On August 9th of 2014, we have Ferguson. This is Black Lives Matter first orchestrated stage show.
Right.
In August 2014. So from 41 murders in that first 9 months, 41 murders in the next 3 months in Kansas City. This year in Kansas City, we're not halfway through the year, we have 97 murders.
My word. Okay.
Because we had the Ferguson effect in 2014. Numbers spiked all over the country, especially in Missouri. And then we had the Minneapolis effect in 2020. George Floyd, BS. And,
oh, yeah.
And that spiked them again. And that licensed them. I mean, essentially, the media and black activists and white Democrats virtually licensed these wayward black youths to do their thing.
Okay.
And and the victims of this, overwhelmingly, are the peace-loving blacks in these communities.
And that's something I think people don't really understand, that when you look at the stats, you're right. Victimization is off the charts on that.
Right.
So, okay. All right.
But they don't want to talk about it because the leadership does not want to talk about this. Because when they have a target, and that is white America,
right,
with deeper pockets, you know, why solve a problem when the problem itself is making you tons of money?
Wow. Okay. And we know the history of Black Lives Matter, as you mentioned, but we also know the ties to the Communist Party.
Right.
Black Lives Matter. Speaking about communism and the larger picture, I know in your book you reference that between 1960 and 1980, that 20-year period there, and just to provide one example, hopefully I pronounce this correctly, Newark.
Newark rhymes with pork or cork. Dork.
they lost more than 150,000 white residents.
Yeah.
And then Detroit and Chicago during that same period lost close to 1 million.
White residents, right?
Right. So you've got, okay. So as I was reading your book and thinking about this, and then seeing what's going on social media, in the media and stuff, it's like, man, things aren't like stacking up for me, making sense, because what I'm being told on social media by corporate media as well, versus what you're bringing out statistically, but not necessarily statistically nicely and you know, ushering it out, there are two separate reasons for this white exodus from these urban areas, which is leading to, in my view, additional decay. I mean,
right.
I can't describe this anything differently.
Well, because right now we're going through white flight 2.0.
Which, okay.
And it's interesting, in the last 3 years, the more liberal the city, the more people they've lost. New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles are losing hundreds of thousands of people. Virtually all of them white, affluent by and large.
Okay.
And yet, you've not heard the term white flight apply to this.
No.
They're hemorrhaging. Tampa's not losing people. Houston's not losing people. The big woke cities are losing hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands. The total among them is in the millions. They're overwhelmingly white, the people departing. And they're departing because of the very programs that these people voted for. Many of them did. Actually, the saner people are the ones leaving. But so, for instance, what's driving them out of a city like San Francisco now or Los Angeles isn't the same thing as it's something like what happened in the 60s. Except that now, since it's liberals who are leaving and it's affluent liberals who are leaving, none of the stigma that was attached to us in the 60s is attached to them today.
Interesting. Okay.
And they don't want to talk about this at all. I mean, you have to read between the lines to find out about it.
Wow.
But because they're the ones who are leaving, right? And the blue collar people who are forced out in the 60s can't leave because, you know, you can't fix a water pipe remotely, right?
Right.
I mean, you need people on the ground, you know, people to do things, to do work.
But oh, I can't. Can I ask this? I mean, if you've got this massive white exodus, shouldn't you have what is filling that vacuum?
That's a good question. And the answer is, look at a city like San Francisco.
Right.
Which is my favorite city. I've been there 15 times. I love to go in there up until about 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And you take America's most attractive city, and in a 10-year span, you turn it into America's most repulsive. Where, you know, they have now apps called SnapCrap. Where you can,
I've seen that.
Avoid piles of human poo. You know, it's shocking, and it of course doesn't fit any of their agendas at all. So, it's forcing itself into the news. And if Gavin Newsom is the Democratic nominee, we're going to hear a lot about San Francisco. But and New York is the same. You know, and then you have the Soros appointed DAs.
Right.
You have city councils that are woke, and we're seeing it in Kansas City even. I mean, even in regular cities that are would seem sane and normal have been taken over by these forces. And it's not a good sign for the future of America.
Well, I've got a problem when I can't mention, if I see a crime, or if I'm going to write about a crime that took place, you can't really mention the perpetrator is black and the victim is white. Or I see newscasters do the same thing, not mention, well, we're not going to say that this person was black or a minority or whatever, which is not a minority anymore, I guess. I've got a problem with everything that's going on right now. What's the objective behind this? I mean, who in the larger sense is pushing all of this? And what's the end game here with this exodus?
Well, that's an excellent question, because when I watched the reparations debate and I looked at the three panelists who were on the opposition, one was the city councilwoman from Kansas City who was behind the move to start a reparations commission in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. The other was this woman from Evanston who successfully launched a thing in Evanston, a reparations plan in Evanston. And the other was this surly guy who wouldn't even look at me in the eye. I mean, this older black guy who has been beating this drum for probably 50 years. And they have different motives. But basically, it is the embrace of victimhood. The embrace of forever being able to put your failings, both as an individual and as a community, on the backs of other people. So you never have to take responsibility for who you are or what you do. And the white left obliges them, and I don't think they understand this, by denying them their agency, by stripping them of black people of their agency. And I think they have not seen or have not wanted to see, certainly at the leadership level. We know there's so many sophisticated black conservatives out there now who have seen right through this and we've never had as many solid, smart voices,
right,
of the Candace Owens, Thomas Sowell School, and we could go on down the list, who see through it and are horrified by it. But what white liberals have been telling blacks now for 65 years is it's not your fault. And we introduced this notion in the 50s. And this is going to seem like an odd reference, but I was watching West Side Story, the new version. Have you seen this by any chance?
I haven't.
It's surprisingly good.
Really?
Surprisingly fair. And it's surprisingly tough-minded.
Okay. I'm going to take your word for it.
Yeah, I mean, because You know, the right doesn't necessarily like Broadway musicals in the first place. After this, I'm going to talk about interior decorating, another one of my pastimes. But there is the song Officer Krupke, right? You ever listen to the song? Officer Krupke, blah, 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 blah. And what they have is these young hoods are going through a litany of reasons why they're not responsible for their behavior, right? We're misunderstood, sociologically disturbed, blah, blah, and society has done me a terrible trick, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1957. That attitude had already begun to infect the social work world.
Okay.
And we made this transition without anyone really noticing. I'm sure if you looked at it, they could probably trace it to the Frankfurt School and Columbia University.
Sure.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
because a lot came out of that. Gramsci and all those people, cultural Marxists, they were convincing America that targeted groups, the groups that they wanted to target in a good way, were no longer, the system was responsible for their problems. They were no longer individually responsible. So in the book, you saw that I followed the case of several black chroniclers of life in Newark.
Yes.
Probably the most interesting was a woman who was born Sissy Drinkard.
Yep.
And I got into that, her story, because of I was talking to one of the fellows I went to school with. And I said, were there any black people on your block when you were growing up? And he said, yeah, there was this one black family. In fact, their little girl went on to become a famous singer, you know? And I said, who was that? And I said, Whitney Houston? He said, yeah, that's her, Whitney Houston, right? And what I did is I bought the memoirs from Whitney Houston's mom. Whitney Houston became like the most famous singer in the world, I mean. And she talks about growing up in Newark. And her father was in that wave of the Great Migration in the 30s.
Okay.
So when her father comes to Newark, just like, so many other people came at that time, when they arrived in Newark, they arrived just like the European immigrants arrived.
Right.
And the message to them was, you better get a job. Get a job, right? The 50s song, right? Get a job because no one's going to take care of you if you don't get a job.
Right.
So he marries, he has a child, and that's he works at during the Depression at the Singer Sewing Machine Factory. And Sissy talks about what a hard job it was. But during the Depression, you have a job. Right?
Right.
He's supporting seven children and an ailing wife on his income.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter, Sissy, she marries a guy named John Houston,
right,
who lives on my friend's block. So it was Whitney was the grandchild, not the child.
Right.
And she talks about coming of age in the 30s and 40s and 50s in Newark. It's all a forward looking.
Right.
People having jobs. Jobs are plentiful. They were moving up. There's no bitterness. They got along. They lived in integrated neighborhoods, right?
Right.
And so that was the model. The model was you work, you succeed, you move ahead. There may be more obstacles for you than you are for the average white person, but the immigrants are facing similar problems. They can't speak English, for starters. Italians and Jews arrive without any English-speaking ability. The Irish can speak English, but, you know, it's each ethnic group is different. And then we hit into the 50s, into the 60s especially.
Yep.
And the message becomes, you're not greeted by someone saying to you when you come to Newark as an immigrant or as a part of the Great Migration, get a job. We're saying to you, it's not your fault. Come, we'll sign you up for AFDC, welfare.
Yep. Yep.
We'll get you a sliding rent. We'll get you Medicaid. We'll get you food stamps. Oh, there's a father in the house? Well, that kind of screws that, you know? So the net result of that mental shift was a shift from being the black community was resilient, proud, hardworking. They endured a lot, and they came through that relatively good, relatively well. Like I say, they were, in the 1950s America, they were some of the wealthiest people in the world, by world standards, few people in the world were nearly as well off as the average urban black in 1958, say, when Fats Domino.
And think about what what you just said, too. And folks, think about that. Think about what you just said. The wealth held by that the component that of the black community.
Yeah.
And again, what happened? Well,
the messaging changed. It was a dramatic change in messaging.
Yeah. At least, yeah, yeah.
And so you take the case of Sissy Houston.
Yeah.
One thing, even in the Deep South, and I just recently read My Grandfather's Son by Clarence Thomas's memoir. Even in the Deep South, blacks weren't denied entrepreneurship. They were allowed to start businesses, own businesses, have cars. I mean,
right.
This wasn't true in the Soviet Union, you know, or
right.
Most of Europe. In Sissy Houston's case, she's getting a good work as a backup singer. You know, she's a very church oriented, just like her father was.
Yep.
All that family went to church. He was a strong disciplinarian. And that's, she goes through this, she loved her father. And he made sure that all his girls were taken care of and they were respectful and, you know, as black parents did routinely in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a father in the home doing that. You needed a father.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she talks about this, and I integrate this into the book, her story.
Yep.
She's living in, she uses a village to describe where she lives. An integrated part of Newark that was part Jewish, part black, part German. It was on the other side of town. And then she said, in the 60s, things getting ominous and scary and noisy. Then the riots hit in 67. And she says, John and I decided maybe we should get out of this town, right? And then in 1970, they leave for the suburbs. Just like a lot of people did, black, white, you know, Hispanic. And yet, as I mentioned last time, and this is really the heart of my story and why I thought it needed to be told, only the whites were shamed. Only the whites were held accountable.
Man.
And thus I tell, you know, I like to tell stories, and the book is filled with the personal stories of what happens
yep.
when you're dispossessed, when you're displaced. Because in a city like Newark, there are communities like villages like mine own all over the country.
Yeah.
But in our case, we were hemmed in by nice suburbs. And these are working class people. So when I did the went through the 1950 census on my block,
yep.
You saw that list.
Yeah.
There's hardly a blue collar job unrepresented.
As a matter of fact, I like that the one chapter. Janitress?
Janitress, right.
Okay.
Yeah. they list, yeah. You know, in the 50 census, they have to list their, other than like lumberjack, I couldn't think of a single blue collar occupation unrepresented on that block.
Machine operator, rubber molder,
casket maker.
Yeah, undertaker. Yeah, a baker. These
bartenders,
are all
barbers.
Yeah.
You know, and these are kind of jobs that could be. You don't need big industry to do. They're mostly small shops or you know, working for, you know, mom and pops. But janitress, I named the janitress because, as I mentioned, of the 81 male-headed households, 79 of the 81 were employed, right?
Right.
Two were unemployed at
right.
that time in 1950. 30 of the 79 had working wives. And I love the title janitress. One woman lists herself as janitress, which is she's taking pride in her job and in her sex, right?
Yeah.
She's not a janitor. She's a janitress. I just thought it was just so wonderfully self-aware, you know, and proud, right? Like today, if like you're a female and you're in working in a theater, you're not an actress. You always identify yourself as an actor.
Right.
You're running away from your sex. Well, in the 60s, 50s, women embraced their sex. They knew who they were.
Wow.
Okay. But they also knew, just like black families and white families alike, on my block, and that block in 1950, there were 14 immigrants from 14 different countries, including outliers like Finland and Turkey. And when they got to Newark, rhymes with cork or pork, like God intended, they knew they had to support themselves. And same thing with the blacks coming up from the southern, you know, the Great Migration. But starting about late 50s into the 60s.
Wait a second, though. So we had immigration then. Just to be clear, we had immigration back then, and it worked, right?
Yeah, and but what happened, and this changed the dynamics of the cities, in 1924, Congress greatly curtailed immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe so that there could be no more great floods of Italians or Jews to replace the more upwardly mobile Italians and Jews in those neighborhoods.
Right. And said, we're going to curtail it from there and open the doors to whom?
Well, the great migration from the South never stopped. There was no
right
attempt to limit that. So the balance changed. It's going to change anyhow.
Right.
So, I mean, the cities would get increasingly blacker anyhow. Because as,
right,
as let's say, immigrants who had been here for 50 years built up some money, wanted to, a lot of people just naturally wanted to move where they got a garage, a backyard, a swimming pool. That's the only natural.
A little patch of grass.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
We didn't have any of that. We didn't have yards or pools or any of that. So there was a natural movement, a large part. But what augmented it, what facilitated it, is the fact when the neighborhoods began to collapse, well, the working class people who lived on Myrtle Avenue, my village, could not afford to move to the nice suburbs nearby. They had a hopscotch, typically about 50 or 60 miles down the New Jersey shore. And shore is too nice a word for, because they didn't live on the beaches.
Right.
They lived in these makeshift communities being, you know, carved out of the pine barrens. And communities, and I tell the story here, my own silly misadventure, and a very telling misadventure as a 17-year-old, going to one of these places. And even as a 17-year-old, I saw what they didn't have. They didn't have movie theaters. They didn't have diners. They didn't have shops up and down the streets. They just had a strip mall here and there, you know?
Right.
There was no church in the middle of their neighborhood. There was no neighborhoods. There was no sidewalks. There was no community. Hmm. And that was the trade-off. And so many of the people I talked to were so unhappy when they realized what they had left and what they had gotten in return.
Interesting.
But they didn't feel like they had a choice. I mean, like these two sisters I talked to who left right in the middle of the 1967 riot because they were in danger of being killed, you know?
That's right. Okay, yeah.
Which is an incredibly harrowing story, and they shed some unbelievable light on it because they saw what unfolded where they were bringing in chartered buses filled with rioters.
Nothing's changed. I mean,
yeah, right.
Okay,
we have right. We have like what do they call it? AstroTurfed riots. You know,
yeah. So okay, putting all of this together here, because again, I think this is a fantastic book. And folks, you know me; I'm a voracious reader. I really am. Ask Eric. I can say that word. I can't say Newark properly.
Newark.
Newark. New Orleans. Okay. Yeah, Newark. Okay. Untenable is the name of the book. Jack Heschel is the author. You know Jack from his numerous books. Okay, so you know it's a good book already. So order it now. Untenable, the story of white ethnic flight from American cities. You know, we have to have a conversation about this. We really do. And if you want to have a conversation about this, then get the book. That'll help you in your conversation about what's taking place. So here we are in 2023. You went through a whole litany of things that has taken place, including this exodus from urban centers. Now, okay, if you don't mind, let me get in the weeds a little bit.
Sure.
Okay. You got people like Klaus Schwab and others wanting these 15-minute cities, these 15-minute urban centers in the because of climate control and all that crap. You've got an open southern border, unfettered access. You've got a bunch of lawlessness through Soros DAs. I mean, And now, like you were talking about having a reparations debate, now they're talking about reparations of people who, in my view, don't even deserve it.
No, they deserve it. They know no more deserve it than you and I deserve it. I mean, we all have grievances of some sort, you know.
So okay, my question to you is, what's going to happen, and what are we going to do about it, and what's going to happen if we don't do something about it?
Well, you know, you raise an excellent point, because the 15-minute city depends on a very high level of civil order.
Yes.
So, I mean, so you have the urban cities in America, the walkable cities in America, like San Francisco or New York, historically.
Yes.
Functioned only because they were orderly.
Right. The non-existent, anymore, New York and...
Right. So if you're going to compel people to live in these tight spaces and high rises, take urban public transportation.
Right.
That's what a 15-minute city is.
Yeah.
You need a level of confidence that you're going to get from point A to point B safely and get back.
Correct.
Right now, that's gone and virtually every major city in America. And then you have cities that were historically very safe, like Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Which they've turned into a hellhole. I mean, and it's, or Minneapolis. Cities that were historically...
Gee, what do these cities have in common?
Let me think.
This is a tough one.
The wokeometer is the gauge here. I mean,
yeah.
And they won't face up to it stares them in the face. And, you know, because I was doing it, I did an article on White Flight 2.0, and I was trying to read the literature today about these emptying cities. And the media occasionally brings themselves to acknowledge that these cities are losing population, the New York, Sam, and they'll say, and they refuse to fulfill the equation.
Exactly.
To finish the equation.
Yep.
What do they have in common? Well, what do New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles have in common? That Tampa and Houston and Jacksonville don't have in common? You know, my daughter and grandchildren live in Tampa. It's you don't see homeless people on the street. You don't see Walmarts being raided, you know? You see more and more people wanting to move there.
Yeah.
In fact, it's incredible.
To be fair, any place will have a section where you might want to stay home after midnight or whatever. But I mean, as a whole, yeah, you're exactly right.
I mean, you look what Giuliani and Bloomberg did in New York City.
Yeah.
They took a city with 2,500 homicides a year and reduced it to 300 or 400.
And I worked in New York City in that blissful period, okay?
Right.
And I was there really Sunday through Thursday, and sometimes Saturday through Thursday. I never felt unsafe. I took the subway.
Right.
I really never felt unsafe unless I was doing something really stupid in a stupid place.
No, as recently as pre de Blasio, Manhattan was the safest big city in the world.
Yeah. And now I wouldn't, if my wife said, hey, let's go back to Manhattan or whatever, you know, show me where you were and what you're doing, I wouldn't take her.
Right.
I don't know.
And the 60s was a preview of what was to come, because we experienced this enormous spike in crime.
Right.
Between roughly 1960 and 1980, it depends.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking 4, 6, 8-fold increase in murders and aggravated assaults and robberies. And
the stuff that...
We weren't allowed to talk about it, let alone talk about the causes of it.
Yeah.
But it did not affect at that time the affluent elites who could sort of avoid it.
Right.
But in the 2020s, it begin to catch up with them. Mm-hmm. And you're right, then they had bought into the whole idea of the 15-minute city, and a lot of them bought condos in the city, and it's a shame, and it's so unnecessary. And part of the reason I wrote Untenable is just to the degree that I could alert people to the fact that it is unnecessary, that it hurts the people most who are allegedly the victims of our racism, We're not the problem.
We're not the problem. But how do we fix? So I guess, I mean, we've got about 11 minutes, 10 minutes left. I mean, how do we fix this? I mean, because we cannot, this is untenable.
Right.
Hence the name of the book, boy. What do you think of that?
You know, we had the opportunity in 2008. Barack Obama could have been the kind of person who could have resolved it. Instead, he totally aggravated it.
Yeah, beer summit instead.
Beer summit, yeah. Right. I mean, from the beginning, he began to racialize
That's right.
every incident. And that culminated with, I took it very, my book is entitled on Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin case, If I Had a Son.
Mm-hmm.
That was That's the right. Turning point where instead of telling the world the truth about what happened that night, where a young man who so typifies what went wrong in America, Black America, who was the victim of two or three successive family breakups, who had devolved from a model preteen to a street thug, who was now into burglary, into guns, into drugs. Yep. Who was out on a drug run that night? Not he wasn't getting his little brother,
Now they want to ban Skittles.
He was down at the 7-Eleven getting the ingredients for Purple Lean and exchanging doobies with these guys.
Yep.
And then he's...
But you won't hear about that.
No, and he viciously attacks an Hispanic neighborhood watch captain. And Obama had the chance to tell the truth about that story. Had he told the truth then, we would never have had Black Lives Matter. We would never have had the Ferguson, and all that ensuing violence and death. But instead, he gets up there and said, well, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
So you, if I'm hearing this correctly, you blame this guy. You blame this mope right here.
For the aggravation. I mean, because he had the chance, unlike, let's say, George Bush or unlike Donald Trump or Joe Biden, he had the chance to reach out to Black America, as he did in that Father's Day speech in 2008,
oh, yeah.
and say, here's the problem. But instead, he got intimidated into shutting his mouth, and then he got further intimidated into becoming a spokesman for the woke end of the Black civil rights movement, such as it is. Al Sharpton visited him 70 times in the White House. You know, that tells you just about all you need to know. And it's a shame because we all want the problem to be solved.
Well, is there even a problem?
Yes, there's a major problem. If you live in a city, as I do, you know the problem. You know, and it's it hangs over your head. It's a Damoclean problem. Yeah. It's not a daily thing, but that sword is always there.
Wow.
And so when they had the George Floyd protests in Kansas City.
Yep.
In 2020,
yep.
the largely peaceful protesters came within a block of my house. And the...
I got to ask you, how did you feel at that point?
Locked and loaded.
Locked and loaded.
I got my shotgun. I said, well, this can handle six shells. Let's load it up. I hadn't done that before. But I live in a liberal neighborhood. I mean, they were these were Eloy, and the Morlocks were coming.
Were you looking at your neighbors like?
I'm not expecting any help from them at all. Meanwhile, the helicopter's overhead, and the newscasters, I was watching the local news, are kind of rooting for the protesters.
Oh, right? Yeah.
I said, are you crazy? Now, I will say that Kansas City wasn't Minneapolis. I mean, but they broke a whole lot of windows, and they, caused a whole lot of havoc. And
but they were mostly peaceful.
They were, most of them were peaceful, except for the ones who weren't peaceful, What I did notice, I'm going to make a comment that's both sexist and fat shaming.
Good. I like it.
I drove by. This was, of course, during, we took a break from COVID season. I thought, hey, if nothing else, this will end the whole COVID mania, but we didn't. We just got a two-week reprieve.
Yeah.
my office, between my office and my house, is about 2 miles, but in between is the big staging ground for these protests, right? Mm-hmm. So I drive by it every night. And so for the big Sunday thing, when it was the biggest, my wife said, what are you seeing? I said, well, I saw a lot of chubby girls with pink hair, right? The real hardcore don't show up until later, right?
Right, right.
But from my office window, which was right in the middle of right on the main drag of the counterculture neighborhood in Kansas City, such as it is, I saw those out-of-state cars coming. And I saw those young, strapping white guys with backpacks that they had a hard time putting on their backs because they were filled with stuff, you know? So you had the sheep down here willing to do and say anything.
Yep.
Then you had the out-of-state agitators, which is exactly what they were.
Right.
And then you have the young black thugs who are willing to just, you know, opportunists take advantage of a lot of free-for-all if you're breaking into the Nike store or whatever. And that was the mix.
They break into the Carhartt stores or, you know, I guess the safest place I've been would have been standing in the middle of a work boot aisle somewhere. But anyway, going back to what you, never mind. Okay. Yeah. Wow.
And it's and in a sense, it symbolized what we're facing today.
Exactly.
An alliance of activists, sheep, and opportunists. And none of them have any interest in solving the major problem at hand. And that is the breakdown of the black family and the subsequent collapse of the black community. And you can't even use those words in public conversation because people say, oh, what are you talking about? Well, when you see a murder rate that's 47 times higher than your neighbor's, you see that there's people are getting their hearts broken and their lives shattered by a failure to address these issues.
It's the guns.
Yeah, that's what they say. But I can tell you that from my friends in Johnson County, they don't measure guns by how many guns you have. They'll have how many gun safes do you have? You know. you didn't get the latest model AR-15? Those guys are loaded, and suburban guys, the rural guys, they don't have to worry. They're taken care of. It's the people who live in and near cities that are going to suffer most. But we're all going to suffer sooner or later.
Yeah, I'm afraid we are. Do you have hope?
Yeah, I'm always hopeful. I'm an optimist, and I remain stupidly optimistic about most everything, but I wouldn't be writing books if I wasn't hopeful. You know.
There you go.
And let's face it, and Doug, I really admire what you do and what Susan does and all those citizen journalists out there who are doing all the heavy lifting for the major media. And, you know, even if you're just retweeting stuff on Twitter or sending off images on Facebook or buying my book and perfect gift for 4th of July, I would say. You know,
I'll tell you what, good summer read. Good summer.
It's actually an easy read, and it's kind of.
Hey, Eric, here. Let me do your job for you, Eric. Let's see. There we go. All right. Untenable.
And I write to be read. I write it to so that it's enjoyable and relatively easy to read. I don't like to depress people.
No, you know, when I went through this, I was not depressed at all. As a matter of fact, it brought back a lot of. I mean, I remember growing up, the Davy Crockett hat, the shows, the things that you referenced, and then to realize, understand how and why everything kind of went downhill, and the stories that you tell, how you tell them, and the way you, essentially the way you left off and you do provide hope, I think.
I also wanted to provide a reach out to my parents' generation.
Yes.
And those, you know, slightly older than us and tell their children, help them understand. I mean, they don't deserve your sympathy. They don't deserve your pity, but they do deserve the truth. And unless you know that truth, and it's the truth, it's not
the truth.
Their truth.
Right.
It is the truth. Then you're part of the problem.
Man, you hit that right on the head. Folks, Jack Cashel. I'm so proud to have Jack Cashel and Susan Daniels in office in the studio as we speak. Jack Cashel, author of many books, including his latest, Untenable. Go to Amazon right now, and order this book. You're going to be glad you did. When you get done reading it, you're going to understand why. There's this mass exodus away from the cities. What is going on? What's causing it? What has caused it historically and even currently? And again, Untenable, this the true story of white ethnic flight from America's cities. See, I read that slow, and you were able to get it. Write it down. If not, there it is on your screen. And I appreciate you, Jack, for coming. I really do. I look forward to having you.
I'm totally grateful for you to have me here, and I'm always pleased to see Susan Daniels here because she's
going to hear from her hopefully in a minute. But two back-to-back days, you being here, I love it. Thank you, my friend.
Okay, very good.
All right. That'll do it, folks. The Hagman Report. Don't forget, Sunday, just 7 p.m., supporters meeting. Have a great night.